If I'm someplace and I hear what I call the Zen bell, the Zen bell is the thing that makes a sound like this. Ding. It's really tiny. But sometimes that tiny little notation is louder or more significant than anything else.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, the upcoming printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today I have the distinct and complete honor of talking with Joel Meyerowitz. Joel is the definition of street photography and has been for decades now. His work has appeared in the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Getty, the Tate Modern. He's the author of more than 25 books, and you cannot do street photography without knowing about Joel Meyerowitz. His work has been defining and transforming for quite a long time. Joel, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Scott. I'm great. Thank you for that lovely intro. God, have I been around that long?
Well, it may be, but I mean, I was teasing somebody the other day. If they put street photography in the dictionary, your picture would be the one next to the definition. it's you have a new book out, and it is a wonderful book. It's called How I Make Photographs, and it's part of the Masters of Photography series. And before we get into the book itself, which is a fine book, could you say a little bit about the Masters of Photography series? What is that, and what is its hope?
Oh, I tell you, I am so pleased to be a part of that group. About 4 years ago, Chris Ryan, who's a photographer himself in London, came to me and said, you know, the time is right for an online photography class. The smartphone has bred over a billion people on the planet, you know, into wanting to be photographers and improving their game. He said, and I think the time is right to do an online course. And this was right about the same time as Masterclass came out in California. Of course, they're not only photography, they're, you know, writers and performers and script writers and things like that. So Chris and I sat together for a while, and I liked how honest he was, how familiar he was with photography itself, and how he wanted to be this generous offering, to make this generous offering of qualified photographers who can teach. And so together we worked up what it turned out to be 35 lessons, and the course runs 5.5 hours, and the modules, as we call them, are anywhere from 4 minutes to 10 or 12 minutes. And they take on, in my case, street photography, landscape photography, portrait photography, shooting from a moving car, interiors, you name it. Anything that has a photographic question attached to it that has become of interest to me in the course of my life is something that I try to share in the most simple and direct way, no secrets held back, just give it all away. And it's a very reasonable price. I think it's about $160 or $70 for 5.5 hours. And we've made a community now, and there are a number of other photographers, Albert Watson and Steve McCurry and David Yarrow, who is a remarkable animal and wildlife photographer. And we've just brought on a woman photographer who works for National Geo. So I think it's growing, and it's beginning to embrace younger photographers too, who are young masters or up-and-coming masters. So that was the genesis of it. And it's been of real interest to me to read the feedback that people give and the questions they ask. I go on almost every week or 10 days or so, and I read the questions that people ask as they take the course, and I try to answer them so that it has a kind of ongoing relationship to it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And so this book grows out of those courses?
Yeah, well, I have a publisher in London called Lawrence King Publishers, who did the book that you and I were talking about before, Where I Find Myself. And as soon as they saw this course, they said, oh, we've got to distill it into a book. And so we took the spoken word from 20 of the 35 lessons, and we condensed that into the text for a book. And what I particularly like about the feel of this book is the size of it is the kind of thing you can sort of stick in your shoulder bag or your pocket or your jacket pocket. And it's a little Bible you can carry with you when you're out and everything. And the tone of the text is just like we're talking right now. I'm speaking directly to the individual. I tried to make it as intimate a presentation as possible so that it feels like a one-to-one relationship. And I think that's important in communicating the richness of photography and the issues that will come up for almost anybody who tries to work on the street or tries to make portraiture or tries to figure out what the hell a landscape might be. There are, you know, we all bump into the problems that photography poses on our way to finding our own identity. And I think this book is really, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I couldn't agree more. And I want to add very quickly for those who are listening, this is not a technical book. This is not, you know, if it's drizzle, use F7. This is a book about attitude. This is a book about how you approach craft and aesthetics much more than the mechanics of a camera. That intimacy that you talk about, I think, is present from page one.
Yeah, well, you know, technical stuff, people can figure out technical stuff on their own. I mean, the way cameras are made now and the whole digital process is, you can figure it out. But it's a lot harder to figure out how to know when to take a photograph or how to position yourself so you're invisible. And I think by answering these emotional, physical, sensory issues, that I could come closer to individual students that way.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could unpack a term for me. This is, again, from Where I Find Myself. But at the end of your commentary to chapter one, which, for those of you that know the book, Where I Find Myself is in reverse chronological order. You start with what was then your most recent work and move back. But you, at the end of your writing for chapter one, you say, it's here that I now find myself once again loving photography's provocative generosity. And that phrase just knocked me over, provocative generosity. Unpack that a little bit for me. What do you mean?
Oh, well, you know, I think at the beginning, when we all start, we're so caught by the magic of it that we go like what they call target fixation. You go right towards the bullseye, you know, whether it's putting someone in the center of the frame or just doing the kind of photographs you want to do. But over time, if you develop your sense of the generosity of the medium, that, yeah, besides street photography, hey, I could do landscapes. Oh, I'm now interested in portraiture. Or I'm interested in mothers and daughters, or any of the subjects that arises spontaneously to the questioning mind of any photographer. That, to me, shows the amplitude and the generosity of photography. And so after doing it for 58 years, which is amazing to me that I'm still as passionate and crazy about it as I am, it still offers me challenges that I haven't dealt with. I mean, for example, this year, on January 1st, I was thinking, what is there that I haven't done in the history of my photography that might be a challenge at my age and with my skill set? And as I went through the various versions of photography, I realized I've never really done self-portraits. Either I never thought they were important enough for me, or on the few occasions when I did take a picture of myself, I remember thinking, oh, I have to look good in this, you know? And so I thought, how could I be the fly on the wall in my own life? And you know, I use Leica cameras. So both of my Leicas, or all three of my Leicas, have 12-second time exposures. So I thought, well, if an impulse comes to me that, oh, this is an interesting moment that I'm in right now, how can I make a picture of this? I could set the camera on 12 seconds, and then I could just go live in the space, and the camera will take a picture of whatever I'm doing, and I don't have to pay attention to it or try to look too good. And so maybe it will be like me having my own personal photographer around. And you know something? I'm 188 days in, and I have made a picture every single day, and sometimes many different ones during the day, because I find as the day unrolls, interesting things happen. I think, oh, I'll do that, you know? And so it's a game, and I intend to call the book, are you ready? Playing with Myself.
Okay, that'll be a tough one to ask for Christmas, but
I just love the double entendre of it. Yeah, you know? But in fact, it's what I'm doing.
But Joel, I looked at some of those pictures on your website, and I think they are all remarkable pictures. But what struck me, when people are thinking portraits or self-portraits, a lot of people go to the hyper-controlled environment. You know, they get out all the lights, all the backdrops, all the, you know, any, you know, spend hours and hours in post-production. You've set up to do these self-portraits as much or with as much serendipity, as much accident as street photography. Was that something you thought of, that, you know, these have to be spur of the moment? Or did you say, that's just who I am, you know, and that came naturally?
No, I knew that it had to, in order for it to be true, for me, it had to be existing light, because I always work with existing light. It's part of the joy. You know, sometimes, you know this yourself, you sit around and suddenly there's a tonal change in the room. The light has shifted a little bit towards gold, and suddenly the room is glowing in a funny way, and you wake up to it and you think, oh my God, how fantastic. It just changed from nothing to something. And it's in those moments that I feel, oh, I'm going to insert myself into the moment somehow. I'm going to use the natural ambience of that time. And it's part of what makes it fun and playful, is to work against conditions. The other night, we're getting ready for bed. It's about 11 o'clock. And we in this farm, I live on a farm in Tuscany. And in the farm, what was an old barn, there's a big arched window. And as I was putting out the lights in the house, I look up and there's the moon in the window. And the window is about 12 feet up on the wall. And I'm standing there in the dark, in the semi-darkness, looking at the moon and just spellbound. It was full moon. And I thought, oh, I should take a picture of this. Now, it was damn hard. It was so dark. It had to be quite a long time exposure. But I've made a picture of myself, and you can see the window. The camera's at some crazy low angle. But there I am in the darkness staring at the moon, like a wolf howling at it. And I'm thinking, that's the challenge of photography, is to be able to make the photograph in the existing conditions, because that way it will be a surprise.
Do you think that kind of awareness can be taught, or does that come from just repeated failure and experience? Because you say here, again, this is another quote from your writing, you say, suddenly there's a sense, but never certainty, but there's a sense that there are elements gathering together in front of me that might produce something interesting. You're describing a way of living that is hyper-aware to light and composition and the rest of it. Is that a talent, or is that something else?
Well, you know, there's a funny way to parse this. I think that I've developed this over the course of my life. Photography itself has taught me how to pay attention, so that it's the nuance. If I'm someplace and I hear what I call the Zen bell is the thing that makes a sound like this, ding. it's really tiny. But sometimes that tiny little notation is louder or more significant than anything else in the surrounding. It's as if everything else is a distraction, and that one little tiny note is the thing that calls me to attention. I've learned to trust that. It's as if that thing has reached into me, deep into my core, and it's pushed aside all the distractions so that something essential is vibrating, and it makes me say, what's that all about? And I go there to that thing, just like the other night, you know, putting out the lights, getting ready for bed, and I stare at the moon, and suddenly I'm aware, oh, this is an opportunity to make a photograph, right? I mean, it's so close. It's almost, you know, a lost cause until it isn't.
I love the way you said that. You speak somewhere about, you know, what the photographer really does is create relationships by putting frames around something, by putting, you know, limiting the picture, I guess. Do you see in frames, when you look out your window, are you seeing, you know, 85 different possible relationships you can create?
Well, it's true. I do see in frames because I've been trained to look through a rectangle for 58 years and to recognize that the essential part of the rectangle, because after all, you can swing the rectangle, you know, 180 degrees or 360, whatever you want. You could move that rectangle until the stuff that really speaks to you, the game you play with the edges, what's in the picture and what's out, that's what makes it a photograph. When you put the camera down, it becomes life again, existing in 360 in every bit of the arc of the circle. So it's 360 vertically, 360 horizontally, 360 diagonally. It's life is happening everywhere. And so by seeing in the frame, it's like it's a game. It's the game of sight. And how dynamic and how interesting you can make the frame is the game that I've learn to play. And that means I don't know beforehand what I'm going to leave in and what I'm going to put out. But as that camera slides across the visual space in front of me, the field in front of me, it strengthens. It becomes fixed in some way. I begin to recognize the dynamics of it. And I begin to feel, by the way, because I think it's all about feeling and meaning. Even though these are things that people don't like to talk about because meaning is so various, mm-hmm. What means something to me doesn't necessarily mean something to anybody else. Still, you have to find what means something to you so that it's strong enough to stop you in your tracks and draw you into it so that you have a relationship with it, a felt relationship, because if you don't vibrate with a sense of the meaning of this to you, how it fits into your recognized sensitivity, your aesthetics, then you'll be lost forever. So if you have developed an identity, and the identity isn't only one thing, it's a way of understanding and reading the invisible text of the world. If your identity is strong enough for that, then you'll begin to expand and become bigger than yourself, and you'll welcome in unexpected visions that reinforce your sense of how you see the world. And so it surprises me. And frankly, I live for that.
You have a chapter in the book called Looking for Detail and Getting in Close. And you're also talking about, you know, speed and a kind of intuited understanding or intuited hope that what you're looking at is going to say something larger. Talk about getting in close. Talk about, you know, developing that sense of what details matter. How do you know?
Well, you know, I use that as a lever, basically, because I've had a lot of experience teaching students street photography. And I watch on the street how often people are shy and they don't want to get into the right relation and distance to people they might be photographing. And then that confuses them and they don't know where to look. And so I was suggesting that sometimes it's a tiny detail, a note, bing, that sparks your attention. It could be the way a young woman on the streets, the T-shirt she's wearing or the blouse she's wearing has slipped off one shoulder, and you suddenly see the curve of that shoulder glistening in the sunlight, and you're standing in the middle of Fifth Avenue where men are wearing business suits. And suddenly this little bit of flesh on a shoulder is the invitation to pay attention. So I say, use that detail as the starting point to draw your willingness to go a little bit closer. So that shoulder in sunlight plays off against all the steel and glass and granite of the buildings and the dark suits of the businessmen, and suddenly this vulnerable, fleshy human being has set it all off. I said, so it's not that you have to run up and take a picture of the shoulder, but you use it as the key to put into the lock that will unlock the picture for you and unlock your resistance. Because it's like a teaching tool in a way. What is it that is that Zen bell that calls you to pay attention? You know, I don't see that only now. Of course, I've learned how to read the moving text of the street so that I see things in relation to each other quickly. I've developed that kind of sight reading, like a good musician can read music, you know, and just get the whole thing, the whole phrase in one gulp. But for students, I think it's encouraging to be able to say, you know, go for that, let the detail pull you, because as you move towards it, your other details will come up and you'll begin to start to assemble the phrase that the picture may yield afterwards. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It makes perfect sense. And it strikes me that a baseline in here is, you know, learn to trust your own sense of engagement and interest. You may see something on the street that you think, oh, this is fantastic. You get to the computer and you say, well, yeah, sorry, this one didn't work. But you still took the shot. You still followed the curiosity.
And you know, if I can just add something there, I think what's good about that is, sure, you may make that picture and it may not be a well-made photograph that you'll keep. But when you look at the run of pictures in Lightroom or whatever you use to look at your pictures, you might see that on that day you hit similar notes four or five times during the day. And when you look at that, let's call it a contact sheet, when you look at that contact sheet, you may begin to observe that, oh, this is a subject that I've actually become interested in. Maybe if I concentrated on that, I will start to develop a body of work that will reveal my identity to me.
That strikes me as really, really interesting, because we talk about writers having voices. We talk about musicians having voices. Photographers have voices as well. You touch on it a little bit in the chapter called Be at One with Your Camera, you know, where you're almost arguing a one lens approach for people for a while. You know, find the lens that's best, not for your subject, but for your voice. Do you think that's tough for photographers to come to understand?
I do, because I think a lot of people buy a camera and it comes with a zoom lens. It might be 28 to 135 or 90 or something like that. And so people think, oh, I got the zoom, I'm going to use it. And so they're sitting in a cafe in Paris, and there's something on the street that's happening, and they just use the zoom on the cafe. And then they make a picture, and it doesn't really add up to anything. Had they gotten up when they saw the thing that interested them and walked within the space that event was happening in, they would have actually sensed the human interaction, the unfolding storyline, and they would have gotten a different feeling about it because they had made the effort. So I'm advocating a prime lens as part of their training because it makes you be more demanding for yourself rather than lazy and sitting there and letting the Zoom do the work. And so, you know, I'm trying to be effective as a teacher by posing an interesting set of questions for someone to take on.
I'm remembering a quote from a writer named Frank Conroy, who said, you know, sometimes the light bulb will appear above your head, but it may be years before it turns on, which has struck me as a good bit of philosophy for photography as well. You think there's something interesting. You have faith in your own work. You have faith in the equipment. So you take the shot, and maybe you don't know what it means yourself for another 5 years, but you still got it, and you've developed, as you said, you find those notes in what you're shooting. Question for you. Another photographer once said the way to succeed, and he's talking business-wise these days, is to specialize, to not only be a nature photographer, but to be a beluga whale photographer, so that if anybody needs pictures of a beluga whale, you're the one they think of first. I'm not so sure I agree with that. Do you think that photographers need to specialize, or are you looking for a broader hope?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that. I'll be honest with you. I'm a generalist in the sense that I'm interested in all kinds of things in terms of my serious photography. But I had to make a living too. And when I was in my late 20s, I started to make a living on the fringes of the advertising world in New York. I had been an art director, so I spoke that language a little bit, and some other art directors recognized in my pictures things that they might use. And so I got sort of stuck, happily stuck, doing what would be now called lifestyle pictures, which then was real life. In other words, I never worked in a studio. I didn't do setups, but they could give me a campaign where I could go out into America and photograph, you know, let's say I introduced the Volvo to America in 69 or 70. And I did a campaign of 22 ads, and they gave me the car and they said, hey, drive all over America and make interesting pictures of the Volvo, you know. So I did everything but put it on a wet pavement, you know, and looking glossy. I drove it through mud. I drove it through ditches. I drove it through, you know, over mountain passes. I drove it in rain. I put it in all the worst places because it was a tough car. And suddenly it became a famous car in America. And I did other things that showed the way people lived. So I got pigeonholed as a kind of lifestyle photographer. And, you know, I was happy to get that work because that way nobody gave me. I remember an art director at Young and Rubicam stopped me in the hall one day back in the 70s when you could actually walk the halls of the agencies and not see what would be an art buyer, but you would see the art directors themselves. And this guy said, Joel, I want to work with you. I got a job for you. He said, I need this bar of butter melting on a plate. And he said, I'll pay you $5,000. Now, $5,000 in 1970 was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this guy and I said, why are you asking me to do this? I do stuff out in the world at large. He said, well, I like you. I want to work with you. I said, well, when you get a job that I can do, call me. But I'm not going to, you know, bend over backwards to melt some butter on a plate. It's not what I do. I'm not that guy. But there are still life photographers in New York who can do this in an hour and bring you a picture that will just knock your socks off. You know, thanks, but no thanks. So in a way, I knew what it was that I could fabricate and what would make me have a good time doing it. You know, so I accepted that limitation. But for my own work, it was, you know, I went from 35 millimeter to 8x10 view camera. I went from street photography to landscapes and to portraits and to other things. So in a way, I served these two gods in different ways. What would I say to someone today? I would say, if you want to be an artist, just follow your instincts and do the things that give you pleasure and demand your attention in special ways. But if you want to be a nature photographer and beluga whales is your excitement, do it so that everybody comes to you for that, and you will get other things from that too. Someone will say, well, you're so good with whales, how are you with elephants?
And off you go.
And off you go.
you have made two pivots recently in your work, the self-portraits, which we talked about just a little bit, but you were doing those still lives just before that. Why, now, I don't know, I don't mean to imply it's a complete change, but why the interest in still lives after so many years of doing street stuff? And the still lives, by the way, are magnificent.
Oh, thanks. Well, look, the same thing held for still lives. Although in all of my years, the only still lives I've ever made, I've never made an arranged still life, like pushing objects on a table. But I have gotten up from a dinner party in which 8 or 10 people were seated, and the candles are burning, the dishes have been removed, but all the wine glasses are there. Everyone has a little ruby of wine left in the bottom. There are dessert plates around or something like that. And I have on occasion seen the beauty of how 10 hands have assembled a sort of accidental still life. Or, right. a found, I think everybody makes a found still life here and there. But about 5 years ago, here in Tuscany, where I'm speaking to you from, it was a summer from hell. The temperature was over 100 degrees every day for 6 weeks. And in the middle of the day, it was impossible to go outside. So this building that I'm talking to you from was an old barn, and there was a hayloft upstairs. And in that hayloft, although it's cleaned, there's a tiny skylight and a studio. And so I found myself retreating to the cool of that loft. And there were a number of objects around that I had found. And a friend of mine here, an Italian guy, had found for me. And so I started to move them around on the tabletop. And I suddenly discovered that these objects had what I would call anima, or soul, or spirit, right, or identity, something. And as I moved them around, they began to have interactions almost like street photography, almost the way people mass on a street and then a single person breaks out of the crowd and runs through them or runs off or carries something. So I started to read the tabletop almost like street dynamic. And so I posed that question for myself. What to you, Joel Meyerowitz, is a still life? And I found that my answers were not about beauty. They weren't about making the Dutch or the Renaissance still life. They were about energies and mysteries and darkness. And I'll point out that one of the big signals for me was the Edward Weston Pepper. Because if you know that photograph, and I'm sure you know it visually, mm-hmm, but do you know the story of that pepper?
No, I don't.
So it was told to me by the man who wrote the biography of Weston, who was a good friend of his. Weston had placed a dark green pepper into an old tin funnel, one of those funnels that's about, 15 inches across, the kind of thing you would use in your car back in the days when there were Model Ts to put oil in the oil reservoir.
Okay.
So this was a dark funnel, and he put this dark pepper in the funnel, and he put the funnel in the furthest reaches of his studio, in the far back. And he told Brett Weston and the boys to leave the studio, because when they ran around in it, the floorboards shook, and he didn't want there to be any shaking. So he put this thing far, far away, and he set up his 8x10 camera, and he made an all-day-long exposure.
Oh, my.
And it was a dark on dark in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that picture now, it's not a strobe lit pepper. It's a pepper that accumulated the light that traveled all the way from the front of the studio all the way to the back. And it basically painted itself over the pepper for hours until the camera logged the data. In fact, if you look carefully at the pepper, you could see where over time the pepper must have shrunk a little bit, because there's a slight secondary edge to the pepper, as if it dried out a little bit over the 6 hours or the 8 hours it was sitting there. And so that inspired me, because everybody thinks of me, those who do think of me, as Joel Meyerowitz, Cape Light, all about the large format and light moving through the frame. And so I wanted to set myself a task of shooting in near darkness, which this studio here has. And I was shooting these dark objects against a dark cloth in the near dark. And I'm using time exposures of minutes, you know, to make this picture. And so began the adventure of what constitutes a still life in the 21st century to me. And,
oh my.
And these crazy pictures have come out of the question. And, you know, once again, it's, can you push into territory that you have never operated in before? And how do you find your way?
One of the things that you've said that, again, strikes very deeply with me, you say that this was in a New York Times interview. You said, I've always felt that photography is a positive art form. Every time I press a button on the camera, I'm saying yes to something I saw. But you also did all of that work at Ground Zero. And how is it possible to stay positive when what you are photographing is tragic and wrong?
Well, I don't agree with the wrong part of that question. And I think the question is definitely a fair one. And I certainly had to navigate that being in there. But, you know, time is a healing process for everybody. You know, we lose our parents, we lose loved ones, we lose pets. We lose, you know, the ball that was our favorite ball, or the marble mm-hmm. that was our favorite marble, or the playing card, whatever. We lose these things and we moan about it. And then time comes and, you know, the days go by and we forget about it. We build. But also light is a healing motif. There were days when I stood in Ground Zero in what was a huge grave site, and the light suddenly in the fall, right? Because this happened in September. So by October, The fall light was raking the site. And there were hours when sunlight was in there, penetrating into the smoke and into the millions and millions of tons of debris. And the figures were tiny little figures on the pile. And I would look at this tableau and I would think, Dare I find beauty in this? Because it was so beautiful. In the background were these skyscrapers draped in red nylon cloth. And in the foreground was the biggest crane in America, painted fire engine red, standing in sunlight and smoke going everywhere. And I'm faced with what was an unbelievably beautiful moment. And for a second, and I'm feeling the sun on the back of my neck, so I know that it feels good to be alive. And yet I'm standing in the boneyard. And I, believe me, I had to navigate the emotional content and properties of that moment and think to myself, do I not photograph this because there are the dead is there, are in there? Or do I photograph this because it's part of the healing agency of time and light? And so I made the photograph. And that happened to me again and again and again. And I realized that part of what I was doing there, part of my job, although it wasn't in the description I gave myself originally, was that I had to select the things that would help us all to see what actually reality was in there, and to also affect some kind of hearing and healing and cleansing by taking these photographs, which basically say time moves us all further and further away from the moment, and those people will be forgotten over time. They may be loved and remembered, but their presence and the pain of it will begin to be reduced over time. They will be part of the fabric in the background. So in a way, it was an incredible human and spiritual message for me in what time does to all of us.
Oh, my.
In terms of grieving and healing.
Mm-hmm. And that question, dare I find beauty? I think that is an incredibly, it's an elegant way to state it. And a challenge, and when all of us go out to do street work or anything else, is so often we take that step back instead of the step toward. I don't want to intrude, or dare I find beauty?
I find beauty. Well, you know, there is another thing. There is in this the notion of the sublime, and the sublime in art has always been part of romanticism. And it's usually been framed by showing you ruins. You know, it's the cascade, it's the collapse of mountains, it's old temples that have crashed to the ground over 1,000 years. And then into the scene walks the viewer, and they stand there as witness to time's destruction, time's decay, and ultimately our own decay. And these are the issues in Romanticism that have stirred the quality that we call sublime. And I found myself in Ground Zero dealing with the 20th century, the 21st century sublime. Here was devastation on an urban scale, vast yet contained. And it had all of the characteristics of that kind of romanticism. And it allowed me to make these photographs and go forward, because I carried that notion in my mind that these things can coexist, the past and destruction and decay, and the present in which we find ourselves standing between the past and the future.
That's really important and very well said. I think the genius behind the excellent photograph versus the merely very good one is that notion in your head. What am I taking a picture of? And what attitude do I bring to it? Joel, it's a wonderful book. We sort of strayed away from it a little bit. The How I Make Photographs, the new part of the Masters of Photography series, is a book that I think you made a good point. It's small enough you can put in your case and carry around with you. It is ongoing and eloquent inspiration all the way through it. So last question here. Tell me what's up next for you. You've still got half a year to go for the self-portraits. What else are you working on?
Well, you know, I'm 82 years old now, and I have work from the earliest years and even through the middle years that never saw the light of day, because the world of photography in those years wasn't as dynamic and as various as it is now. There, you know, in New York in the 60s, there was only one gallery, and it was in below street level in an old Chinese laundry. You know, I saw Ansel Adams had a show in that little gallery in New York. Can you imagine Ansel Adams, the great Ansel Adams, in the Chinese laundry in New York?
And his pictures? I can now.
No, his pictures were $25 a piece.
Oh, my.
So that's where photography was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so and there were very few museums that showed photography seriously. And there were very few publishers that were willing to publish because there wasn't a market for serious books. So I'm at that age now where I have the opportunity, since I've published as many books as I have, there are publishers who are willing to bring these books out now. So I'm having the time of my life going back over work that I did with full heart and real intensity a couple of years in a row, and then, you know, it gets put in the box. In fact, in my studio in New York now, we've unearthed 140,000 unseen Kodachromes.
Oh, my.
Now, I saw those pictures, but, you know, there was nothing to do with them, basically, so they went in the file boxes. And so now there's a place in New York called Digital Transitions who is scanning all of these 140,000 for me at a really remarkable price. Mm-hmm. And I'll be able to see everything and have a file big enough to print from for a book, let's say, and to put into my database. So we're doing that. And in fact, on the 16th, Aperture and I are doing a small print sale of three prints that will sell for $120.20 each, signed mm-hmm. prints, and they benefit Aperture's educational program, they benefit my scanning program, and they'll benefit something called the Equality... I can't remember exactly what it is. It's the equality. Let me see if I find it here. It's called the Equal Justice Initiative, because we're at a time right now socially where we really need to have strong fighters for equal justice. And Aperture and I have done a lot of research, and we want to offer some of the funding we receive from this for that. So that will be offered on the 16th, and it will run for about 10 days on our websites and Instagram and stuff like that. So anyway, it's a way of trying to support these various projects.
That is wonderful. Well, thank you, sir. This has been a fascinating talk. I appreciate your time.
Oh, Scott, among the interviewers I've spoken with over the last number of years, I've always enjoyed our conversations. You seem to bring out, the most challenging questions for me, and I think the ones that are really important for people to think about.
Well, thank you for that. Have a good day, sir.
Okay. All my best, Scott, and I wish you well.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, I can imagine you would like to hear more about what we are currently working on. Later this year, we will be launching a quarterly printed photography magazine. It will be a beautifully designed, inspiring publication. I personally truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper, hence the idea of Frames. To find out more about Frames and to join more than 14,000 photography enthusiasts who enjoy our weekly newsletter, go ahead and visit frames.photography. I would love to have you in our community. Thanks so much.